Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
We live just the way everybody else lives. We live small. Our world is tiny. Well, our inside world is tiny, but our outside world is huge.
Christine Taylor tells us how she and her husband created an off-the-grid but incredibly high-tech life for themselves. Veterans returning from war are getting a boost from the USDA to take up farming for the first time. Make a batch of pickled eggs with Chef Bob Atkins to enjoy over the next several weeks. Quinoa is simple to cook and also simple to make delicious. Chef Daniel Orr has a recipe for us. And Clara Moore went from chef to home cook. She tells us how she's adapted her professional training to suit her small home kitchen. We look at ag news from the week's headlines. Lou Ann Johnson is here.
We've heard the figures about food waste. About one-third of the food produced around the world goes uneaten. Americans alone waste 60 million metric tons of food annually, with over half of that ending up in landfills. A new report by the British organization called Waste and Resources Action Program gives us even more numbers to think about. By 2030, consumer food waste could be a $600 billion a year problem. If we reduce food waste by 20% over the next 15 years, that could save us $120 billion annually. Critics of the so-called Right to Farm Amendment to Missouri's state constitution brought their case to the state Supreme Court this week. Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted reports.
The so-called Right to Farm Amendment is meant to protect Missouri farmers from new laws that would change current farm practices. By a slim margin last year, Missouri became the second state to add the right to farm to its constitution. Critics, including many small farmers and animal rights groups, say the wording of the statute opens the door for foreign corporations to exploit Missouri farmland. Wes Schumacher of Missouri's Food for America.
They certainly won't have the same interest for our rural communities and rural schools and for our workers that family farmers especially are, even American corporations, would have.
Groups supporting the amendment, like many large commodity groups, argue the ballot language should have been challenged before it was approved in last year's election. The Missouri Supreme Court's decision is expected in the coming months. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
Indiana's right to farm bill died this week in the state Senate. The vote on Senate Joint Resolution 12 was close, 22-28. The law that sets standards for the food schools serve is up for reauthorization this year. The Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act aimed to increase childhood nutrition by changing school meals and bringing more fruits and vegetables to school cafeterias. Critics say redesigned meals are expensive and they leave some kids unsatisfied. Many children also end up throwing away the fruits and vegetables they're required to take. The Union of Concerned Scientists, however, supports the law. In a new report, the organization says national data tells a different story. Lindsay Haynes-Maslow is a co-author.
What we want to reemphasize is that there are larger studies that are done nationally, and they look at multiple schools across the country, and they're showing that children are actually eating more fruits and vegetables, and they're not actually throwing away more food.
The current standards are set to expire at the end of September. And this Sunday marks the first day of March, a month that usually means the beginning of a warm-up. But if you're like our blogger, Liz Leslie, who lives up in Chicago, you might be digging out of another snowstorm. Shake those winter doldrums. Liz has compiled a list of 5 posts that will get you excited for longer days, warmer temps, and fresh food growing from your garden. The post is at eartheats.org. Just look for the picture of the tasty meringue dessert covered in red buds.
The website and also our Twitter feed, of course. Get food and farm stories 24/7. Lou Ann Johnson, all right, thanks.
You got it.
Many of the millions of veterans deployed in Iraq and Afghanistan have returned home to resume civilian lives and civilian careers. But it can be a rough transition. Congress wants to help jumpstart the process, and for some, that means a second life on the farm. Harvest Public Media's Abby Wendell has the story.
Sarah Creech turned to farming when her first career fell apart. She has a master's degree in nursing, 16 years of experience, and served as a surgery nurse in the Air Force during the Iraq War. Like as many as 1 in 5 recent vets, Creech came home with PTSD. She said when she tried to return to nursing, her depression and anxiety became so severe, she felt like she was dangerous to her patients.
My sister one day was like, "What are you going to do with your life?" And I told her I had no idea. I said, "I just want to buy a farm and move out to the middle of nowhere and just get away from everything."
The 2014 Farm Bill is helping Creech and thousands of veterans like her do just that. The legislation names veterans as a distinct class of beginning farmer within the U.S. Department of Agriculture. That means veterans are eligible for low-interest rate loans to buy animals and equipment, they can apply for grants to build onto their farm, and they can receive extra payments to implement conservation practices on their land.
More than anything, it's just an acknowledgement.
Michael O'Gorman is the founder of the Farmer Veteran Coalition, a nonprofit organization that helps veterans start careers in agriculture. The Farm Bill could make that task easier. Veterans are not only getting access to the USDA's support for beginning farmers, it requires the department to give their applications priority preference ahead of non-veterans and minority farmers. O'Gorman said it's payment for the time veterans took away from their own goals to serve.
You know, the veterans don't want a handout, but it'd be nice to go to the front of a few lines, because even if one did come home unharmed, many of them didn't, they still took years out of a normal development of a career.
The Farm Bill also sets aside close to $1 million for programs that train veterans to become farmers. It's a tiny part of the $500 billion bill, but it's meant as a first step.
It's an absolute natural fit.
Karis Gutter is the USDA's first military veterans agriculture liaison. The legislation created his position to connect veterans and the nonprofits serving them with the USDA's resources. The USDA hopes these programs are a wise investment. About 2.5 million veterans have returned home from Iraq and Afghanistan, and nearly half of them come from rural counties. A department report from 2013 showed that they have more education and technical training than their non-veteran peers. They also bring unique skills from their military experience.
Many of our men and women who've served the country come from rural America and get training to work with their hands and have a natural instinct for entrepreneurship.
Sarah Creech is proof of that sentiment. 3 years ago, she quit her job as a nurse and used her savings account and support from her family to buy a foreclosed farmhouse sitting on 43 acres of land in rural Indiana.
A lot of people call chickens the gateway animal.
She started out planting an orchard of fruit trees, apples, peaches, cherries, and pears. She added berry bushes and rows of vegetables. And then she bought her first chickens.
Once you have a chicken on a farm, then you end up getting sheep on the farm, and then you end up getting horses, and it just explodes from there.
This year, her Blue Yonder organic farm received $21,000 from the USDA because of her veteran status. She's using the money to improve the quality of her soil and build a hoop house, which will extend her growing season and should increase profits. But that's not her priority. In many ways, she said the work pays for itself.
I am getting out of bed every day, and I am doing my chores every day, and I'm taking care of animals every day. Like, people are relying on me. I don't know where my life is going to take me, but I feel like I'm on the right path.
And she wants to help other veterans find their path, too. Creech hosts veterans groups at Blue Yonder for week-long workshops to give them a taste of life on the farm. Abby Wendell, Harvest Public Media.
More from the Harvest Reporter Collective at harvestpublicmedia.org. Christine Taylor didn't always live like this. She used to have a high-powered big city job. She lived in a suburban home. She had an electricity bill and a landline. So much has changed for Christine and her husband Greg in the past 9 years. Christine calls their situation off the grid, but what that means in 2015 is probably different than you're imagining.
My name is Christine Taylor, and what I do is difficult to answer. I'm a part-time lawyer, and my husband and I live off the grid, which means that we make all of our own electricity with wind and solar panels. Our farm is in a creek valley, so the sun comes up over the hills on the eastern side of the valley right about 7 o'clock. That's when I wake up and sit up and look out the loft window, and I can see out to the pigeon gazebo and the goat yard and the chicken coop. Between my husband and I, we have 7 children. We were in this big city house with 6 bedrooms and 3 stories tall and basically inside the city of Cincinnati. And we had already bought the 63-acre farm, and we fell in love with the property. It had been like a weekend getaway for us, and we would go out camping and just enjoy it and go fishing and hiking and walking. One weekend, at the end of the weekend, we stopped off at this one porch swing, which is by a beautiful fishing hole. And the sun was setting, and it was lovely, you know, the dappled light through the trees, and it was starting to get chilly. And I don't remember who said it, if it was Greg or I, but one of us said, well, what if we didn't have to go back? And we both just were like, yes, what if we didn't have to go back? Maybe we don't have to go back. Maybe we can make our lives out here. We're high tech. We've got cell phones. We've got a satellite internet. We've got satellite television. We have computers. I think we have all the creature comforts, including a crewing coffee pot, which is very nice. My husband and I always eat breakfast together. We usually turn on the internet and see what's happened over breakfast in the world. Then we put the technology away and put on our work boots and go out and do the animal chores. That takes about half an hour every morning. For 2 years, I did drive back and forth from the country to the city. I would wake up in the morning in our little 388-square-foot cabin and with a wood stove. And for the first year, we actually used an outhouse, and we even showered outside. And I'd put on my lawyer clothes and go downtown to the city. And I just felt so smug, thinking, nobody knows what I've really done this morning. But I knew that I felt special. And then we're always building things. We built a greenhouse this past year. We just finished my husband's shop, and then I have a sugar shed where I keep all my maple syruping and honey equipment. You know, one of the concerns I had at first is I had a whole life raising children in the neighborhood and people that I knew so well. Moving to the country, I didn't know how I would make friends, how I would get to know people. This is when we were still just coming out on the weekends. We came out one weekend, and there was a note tacked to the front door and said, my name is Carl. I've been fishing at this creek my whole life, and I know that it's changed. The property has changed hands. I was hoping I could still have permission to fish here. And he left his phone number. So, of course, I called him, and of course I said yes. I don't know how he had found it, but he had been fishing there. He told us for about 50 years, this one fishing hole. And when he passed, his son came to us and said, my father so loved this place. Could we leave some of his ashes here? And of course we said yes. So we definitely feel as though Carl is still with us. And then dinner time comes, and we have a deep freeze that's filled with half a side of beef that another person that we know raised. We have dinner, and then 8:30, 9 o'clock, I'm pretty much ready to climb back up into the loft and maybe read for a little bit and go to sleep. But I think the biggest thing that people that don't really know us and just have heard about us think that we must live the way people lived back at the turn of the 1900s. You know, we live small. Our world is tiny. Well, our inside world is tiny, but our outside world is huge.
Pictures of the farm are at eartheats.org. Christine Taylor will be speaking at this year's National Maple Syrup Festival in Nashville, Indiana. Information about her appearance and the rest of the sweet festivities at nationalmaplesyrupfestival.com. Coming up with Chef Daniel Orr.
Now, if you were to grow your own quinoa, you would need to really wash it well because it's coated with kind of a bitter coating, dusty coating, that the plant creates actually to make birds spit it out.
You won't want to spit out this recipe. No, no. This is a tasty one and very simple. It's ahead on Earth Eats. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations, bloomingfoods.coop. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington, Independent Branch Leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Hello, you're with Earth Eats right now. I'm Annie Corrigan.
I always remember my grandmother having a big jar of pickled eggs with beets, and there were these bright pink pickled eggs and the pickled beets all in there.
Chef Bob Atkins, everybody. As the days start getting longer, your chickens will start laying more and more eggs. We offer you this recipe as an alternative to making weekly 12-egg omelets.
There's really only one surefire way I've ever known to boil eggs, and boiling is a misnomer because really you want to simmer. If you're boiling, you're agitating, you're breaking shells. So you start with the 30 eggs in a pot large enough to hold them. Cover them by at least 2 to 3 inches of cold water. Put them on a high heat. You bring them up to one boil. You turn off the heat, cover them, let them sit off the heat for 10 to 15 minutes. After that, some ice water to shock the eggs. While the eggs are coming up, you can prepare your brine. So I have 8 cups of malt vinegar. To that, I'm going to add some fresh ingredients. I've got 1 large Spanish onion, 2 jalapenos, some garlic, which is going to give it a different type of spice. We're also going to add some red crushed chili flakes, fennel seeds, about 1 tablespoon of dried oregano, some whole black peppercorns, a little fresh rosemary and thyme, a few bay leaves, one of our all-time favorites in pickling. Going to add 1/4 cup of kosher salt all to the mix there. And you could add other things to this. I mean, really, the sky's the limit. Right now, I'm waiting for the brine to come up and heat up a little bit for all those flavors to marry. We boiled and peeled the eggs, of course, or simmered the eggs. We're going to cut a little slit in a crosshatch pattern on the egg, just down to the yolk so that it's going to allow that pickling brine to penetrate a little bit quicker. So we're going to do that to all of our eggs. I'm going to pour the hot brine directly over, and I have here just a stainless steel soup tureen, and then you can transfer them to something else after they've cooled. These will be ready in 2 days minimum. I would love to let them sit a week. And they're going to last a long time under refrigeration in that pickling brine. They've got, and the longer they sit, I think the better they get.
Bob Atkins' recipe for pickled eggs at eartheats.org. Clara Moore made a name for herself in the St. Louis food scene when she worked as executive chef at the local Harvest Cafes. Last year, she picked up and moved to the Pacific Northwest, which resulted in what she called food culture shock. She had to learn about the growing season, which is much shorter than what she was used to in Missouri. And fresh seafood, that was new for her, too. Her technique for getting to know a new place is to go shopping at the local co-ops, mom-and-pop corner stores, and ethnic markets. She talks to people and engages with the food system firsthand.
Not just go to the store like a robot, take the food off the shelves, go through the line, and then go home and unpack it. It's really much more than that. Your butcher knows so much about meat. Ask them what is good today. Ask them what they recommend. Ask them if there's a cheaper cut that you could use. And then the same with the farmers. Or also ask your farmer if they have an excess of something that they might want to let go for a deal. Farmers are business people, and they definitely want to move their product. So whatever they can do to move their product, they're happy with.
Her first cookbook is called Shop Like a Chef. So I asked her for tips the rest of us should keep in mind when we hit the grocery store. First thing she recommends is to buy food more than just once a week.
That's something I would recommend to anyone, anywhere, all the time.
Just shop more often.
Yes, exactly. Especially if you are really interested in seasonal and local, really understanding the diversity of what you can get, the more often you shop, the more you see things changing, and the more you see new stuff and the more you can be inspired.
Relive your days working at Local Harvest in St. Louis. You're shopping for the ingredients for that day. Do you make a list or you just sort of go to the store and see how the spirit moves you?
I would say half and half. So I like to have kind of a general idea. This is for home and for work, honestly. I like to have a general idea of what I may want to eat that week or in the next few days. And then kind of leave them open-ended, like, you know, I'd like to eat chicken. So I pick my protein, and then I go and see what I can mix with that. What's going to be at the store that's going to inspire me or that's going to look so beautiful I can't not pick it up?
So let's say you're going to make a gorgeous chicken pasta zucchini meal. What is an absolute must? Which ingredient must be local, which must be organic, and which can you sort of play with?
That is a lot of, like, a minefield. That's a minefield of a question.
Purposely.
Right. So I would say if it's going to be organic, I tend towards meat, my meats being organic, because I feel like there's a lot more life and a lot more things packed into proteins and meat. Vegetables, I find, should more be local because they're just going to taste better. You know, you can freeze an organic chicken in Washington and send it to Missouri, and it's going to taste basically relatively the same. But you can't pick a zucchini in a field in Washington and then fly it to St. Louis and think it's going to taste as good.
Then I'm also wondering, now that you've moved out there, you're cooking more at home than you ever had at any point in your life. Mm-hmm. Have you learned anything from that? Is there anything you've picked up from just having to do it all the time?
Yes, I have. First of all, I use my freezer a lot. I'll make, like, a lot of rice, and then I freeze the rice. And frozen rice is surprisingly versatile, and you can use it for lots of stuff. Breaking down chicken and then freezing it, breaking down meat and then freezing it. So when you buy in bigger quantities and cook in bigger quantities, you're saving yourself money and time.
She's also now planning ahead with her cooking, preparing meals for the week on Sunday. All in all, she's thoughtful about where she shops, how often, and what she takes home with her. Moore says this gives her food depth.
It really is about more than just going and buying your food and taking it home. It really is about your community. It's about economically your community, but also socially. And that is an extremely important thing. It's not just always about nutrients.
Clara Moore is the author of Shop Like a Chef, A Food Lover's Guide to St. Louis Neighborhoods. Lots of great insider information with recipes and a glossary of food terms. She also contributes recipes to our website, eartheats.org. Recipe for quinoa coming up with Chef Daniel Orr. On the bookshelf at Earth Eats headquarters is a book called Quinoa Revolution, over 150 healthy, great-tasting recipes for under 500 calories. Author Carolyn Hemming and her sister Patricia Green are quinoa lovers from way back, so they're enjoying the recent trendiness of this edible seed.
Yeah, it's kind of taking the culinary world by storm, really.
In fact, Carolyn and Patricia have branded themselves as the Quinoa Sisters.
Not only is it great tasting, and you can use it in a myriad of applications, but it also happens to be a complete protein. It's full of vitamins, full of minerals, great for vegetarians, gluten-free, high in fiber, low glycemic index, complex carbohydrates. I mean, the list goes on.
Here's 1 minute with Carolyn Hemming, where she talks about sprouting quinoa.
So sprouting quinoa, really distilled water, half a cup of quinoa. You want to make sure that everything is really clean, including your clean glass or your dish, and that you've got a lid for it. Pour the distilled water, cover the quinoa, give it a little bit of a stir, and soak it for about 40 minutes at room temperature, and then strain it off after that, drain the seeds, and give them a bit of a rinse with some more distilled water, and then rinse out the dish as well, of course, and then return the wet quinoa rather to the dish and cover it again. Leave a little tiny opening to get a little bit of air in there, and then put it in the fridge or a dark, cool location, and rinse it, you know, every 8 to 10 hours until the quinoa is sprouted to however long you want it. You know, quinoa germinates in 2 to 4 hours, so, you know, you can sprout it really quick and have small sprouts, or you can let it sprout to 8 hours and have a longer, more, you know, substantial sprout.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's been such a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Great. Have a great one.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye. Read the complete interview with Carolyn Hemming on our website. You'll also hear about a recipe for Black Forest goat cheese brownies using quinoa flour. The picture alone will activate your sweet tooth, I'm sure. See it at eartheats.org.
All right. We ready to go?
Do it.
Now, if you were to grow your own quinoa, you would need to really wash it well because it's coated with kind of a bitter coating, dusty coating, that the plant creates actually to make birds spit it out. So birds would eat it and they'd spit it out and it would make the plant grow different places. Grab a spoon.
Chef Daniel Orr has a bag of rainbow quinoa in the kitchen today. It's a combination of white, red, and black quinoa.
Start with a little bit of oil. You could use kind of a pumice olive oil, a kind of inexpensive olive oil. We've got a nice hot pan. Quickly, we're going to add the garlic. Now, you don't want your garlic to get too dark, so you need to have your onions ready. It's just brown, boom. So that was about 2 tablespoons of garlic, 1.5 to 2 cups of onions. We're going to add just a touch of water to that, and that's going to help it steam and cook those onions quickly. And we're going to let that water evaporate out of there. Season these with a little bit of salt and pepper and some thyme leaves. I've got probably about a teaspoon of fresh thyme leaves and a little bit of lemon zest. Again, one of my favorite secret ingredients. Okay, and then in the meantime, you have your quinoa on cooking. And basically what I like to do is to toast the quinoa in just a little bit of oil until it gets a little nutty. Then I cover it with water. It takes about 12 to 15 minutes to cook. Then you let it sit, and then you take a fork and kind of aerate it. And we're just going to check the seasoning. Again, it's so important. A lot of people follow recipes to a T, and then they forget to check the seasoning. A little salt and pepper. Just squeeze a little fresh lime juice or lemon juice on top. And again, this is a great side dish. Wonderful as a bed underneath things, like you could put a piece of grilled salmon on top of it. You could also cool this down, use your leftovers as a salad the next day, or put it in a pita sandwich, or use it just about any way you wanted to. So very, very versatile. And one thing I always have at the restaurant are roasted tomatoes. Throw a touch of the Irish, a little green on top. And there you go. That's our rainbow quinoa with roasted tomatoes and a touch of the Irish.
Find this recipe at eartheats.org. Also, already thinking about St. Patrick's Day, maybe? Try your hand at a traditional corned beef recipe this year. We've got some easy-to-follow instructions on the website, along with a guide to some of our favorite Irish whiskeys. There's a lot to explore. Recipes, news, interviews at eartheats.org. A big group hug to Eabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepherd, and the reporters at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations. Bloomingfoods.coop. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Stay warm, think spring. Earth Eats back again next week. Hope to see you then. I'm Annie Corrigan.